This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Ohl. It's Politics Day. Stefan Schmidt, political science professor at Iowa State University, and New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson are here. Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and Its Possible Repeal are front and center in some political circles. Some want it repealed, some want it continued, and now there's a plan to spend a year studying it. President Obama is talking jobs to the people and even made an appearance at a Republican retreat. Is it enough? Meanwhile, the economy is still struggling, the proposed budget cuts for NASA has few supporters, and the doors are about to swing wide on funding campaigns. Those issues and your calls and emails on Talk of Iowa. First, this check of news from NPR and Iowa Public Radio. This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Ohl. It's Politics Day. Don't Ask, Don't Tell is in the news. Budget cuts for NASA, the ongoing issues with the economy, almost enough to make you think that health care was the big issue just a few weeks ago. Joining us this week, as always, Stefan Schmidt, political science professor at Iowa State University, joining us here in our Des Moines studios. Stefan, welcome.
Thank you, Jonathan.
And Arnie Arneson, a New Hampshire political analyst. Do we have Arnie on the line? We do not. We're trying to get Arnie Arneson on the line. She'll be joining us momentarily, hopefully. Stefan, let's start with Don't Ask, Don't Tell. This was an issue that was one of the things that President Obama had said that he was going to address when he became president. So far, he has not. There's some issues of continuing it. Now there's a proposal to study it for a year. Where does this fall in the political landscape, and why is this getting attention when other issues like the economy and health care may not be getting as much?
We'll have to make a phone call to the White House and ask the president, because people are wondering why a lot of the things are on the agenda when, in fact, it distracts so much. And, when you have a fire in a building, you want to get the fire department there and put out the fire. You don't want to then also sponsor a little bonfire by the lake and a donut fundraiser on the other end of town and get the fire department all distracted. And that has been one of the real problems with the Obama administration, is that they have not concentrated on a couple of, six alarm fires that the public would like them to focus on and explain. And gays in the military is a commitment he made to the liberal and gay community, who are a very important constituency for him. The other problem is that it's just sort of a weird twilight zone to have a policy that says you can join the military, you can be a medic, a translator, you can fly airplanes and kill terrorists. But don't tell me that you're gay, because if you do, then I've got to kick you out of the military. I mean, it's a policy that is untenable in the long run and makes no sense. So before that, of course, the policy was that you could not be gay and be in the military. But I'm not sure that anything much would happen after all these years. Don't they have some studies sitting on some shelves at the Defense Department with recommendations about, morale and all that, in terms of gays actually being openly serving in the military? I'll bet they do. They just don't want to make a decision. So the easiest thing, governors always do this. They appoint a, blue panel committee, a commission to go study something. Oh, that's Obama. You appoint a blue ribbon panel to study how to cut the deficits, to put off making any decisions. It's a sad situation. I don't understand why in all these years we haven't reestablished diplomatic relations with Cuba. That's another one that I find completely senseless and doesn't add much to national security. We probably could have long ago gotten Cubans to undermine Castro if they had wonderful relations with us, and a lot of American tourists were running around Havana. But that one is another one that's sort of untouchable. So,
do you think the Pentagon's proposal to take a year to study this is just a delay tactic? Do you think they're serious about accumulating information, or is this just let's get it off the headlines for a year?
Oh, I can't imagine that it's that it's anything except to say, we don't want to deal with this one now, so let's go study it, because politically, you know, let's not do it before the 2010 election. And I think probably there were some calls made from the White House saying, even though I made a commitment and I really think we ought to just get rid of this policy, let's please not do it before the 2010 election, because there are already enough spiders running around that are distracting the voters. And I guess maybe it makes political sense, because gay rights and gay marriage and other gay issues still have a way to go in the general public. And so I guess putting it off, I'm guessing that President Obama will still be president. So I'm guessing there'll be an executive order right after the 2010 election, no matter how that comes out, that will say, now we're going to throw this policy out here. We don't have a policy, for example, that you can be heterosexual and join the military, but don't tell us you're heterosexual. And we have a lot of pregnancies in the Navy, especially. The numbers are just staggering. So unless they are spontaneous pregnancies as a result of military duty, there are some things going on there that used to not be permitted in the military among officers and soldiers, and we don't seem to be terribly upset about that.
I think Arnie's joined us on the line. Arnie.
I'm chomping at the bit here. I'm dying away in. First
well,
of all,
go ahead and chomp.
Okay. So I'm listening to my good friend Duncan Hunter on National Public Radio yesterday, talking about this policy. And I want to tell you one of the excuses he used as to why we need to maintain Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And he said the reason why we have the strongest, most feared military on the planet is because of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And I thought about that answer, and I suddenly went and I said, is there any other military that is perceived to be a little more sophisticated, a little stronger, and maybe to some extent even more feared than ours? And what military came into my mind? The Israeli army. So guess what I did? Like a good little doobie, I did a little quick Google search, and sure enough, in the Israeli army, according to Linda Gradstein, gays are no big deal. And it turns out that they have embraced both women and gays in an inclusionary policy for years. And it has not undermined their sophistication. It has not undermined their military, attentiveness. Nothing has happened as a result. So I just want to let people know that as they hear that card being laid on the table, you have to look around the world to see where it's been embraced in other settings. And it hasn't had a negative impact at all, especially when you will hear the most hawkish members of Congress wax poetic about how brilliant the Israeli military is. They better acknowledge this aspect as well.
Well, yeah, it is, because we are a country where religious sensibilities basically lead a lot of constituents to be opposed to any of these things.
Have you met
Orthodox? On the other
Jews
hand, in Israel,
like...
they do too. I mean, conservative Jews also do not approve of gay relationships, and yet they've managed to say, look, we want women. I mean, women have been fighting on the front lines in Israel. They're among the most accomplished commandos. They are fighting with men on all kinds of in all kinds of different combat roles, and have been very successful. So it isn't that; it is really moral values, and it is those questions that lead Duncan Hunter and others to oppose this. So
well, and the one thing is that supposedly, especially in the military, we want to value honesty and integrity, but on this issue, you must be dishonest. Okay? I mean, you've got to trust the person sitting next to you in the trenches or the foxhole or whatever, and that it really is predicated on trust. And then to basically tell people, but on this issue, you must be dishonest. And I hate to say it, but someone's sexuality is a very important aspect of who they are. You know, it doesn't mean that it's going to undermine their relationship when they have an M16 on their back, but it does say that on this particular aspect of your personality, you have to lie to me. And I just don't think that aids to the integrity of.
Well, and the other thing is that, you know, we all went to school. I went to military boarding school, and we all know everything about everyone, even if we don't say it. So, you know, it's not as though it's a well-kept secret. It's just sort of an arbitrary policy. And, you know, if you don't want gays in the military, just go back to the old regulation and say if you're gay, you can't join the military. But this is a you know, a strange sort of frozen in time limbo that is a bit odd. We ought to move on from it. Do we have other issues that need to be resolved?
Let me make a recommendation. There's a really interesting article in something called the Leaf Chronicle, and it's about Fort Campbell. And they go there to talk about the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. And Tavia Green wrote the piece. If anybody wants it, I will send it to you. But it turns out that, you know, Fort Campbell was almost the epicenter of this issue, because it turns out that in July of 1999, this soldier was beaten to death, bludgeoned to death, because a man believed he was gay. Okay? And as a result, what happened was two things interesting that happened. One, zero tolerance was embraced, that you could never harm anyone because of his sexual preference. But at the same time, Don't Ask, Don't Tell came into being. And then what happened was we saw a huge number of gays being discharged in the military. But 20 years later, you go back to that same place and they say, you know what? It's time. It's time. And this was the epicenter of this issue in 1999, and they are so ready to move beyond it.
Let's exit question on this. Why is this taking up so much real estate in the public consciousness at the moment?
It doesn't cost anything. I hate to say it.
Is that it?
Barack Obama needs to embrace something that doesn't have a fiscal note. Okay, he needs something that he's not going to tick off bankers, he's not going to tick off small business people, he's not going to increase the deficit, he's not going to aid and abet the largest defense budget in U.S. history since World War II. This is something that is a social policy that is very doable, that is a long time in coming, that is not going to undermine our military effectiveness, and he needs to kiss the progressives on the cheek and say, I'm still kind of sort of one of you, even though most of you think I've walked away from you.
Yes, and I'll deal with it next year.
Yeah, exactly, my Nana.
You know, I'll deal with it, but I don't want to do it right now because already we are worried about our numbers. Yeah,
exactly.
We're interested in your opinions as well. You can email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can also call 866-780-9100. That's the number to call. We're coming up on a break, and after the break, we'll get into other topics, a little bit more on gays in the military. Other topics will include President Obama is taking some messages to the Republicans and to the people. We'll talk about whether that has been effective. And the economy is still definitely a hot topic. Those topics and more coming up after this break. Again, our email address, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can call us at 866-780-9100. And we'd love to have your phone calls and emails after this break on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. And this is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. Stephen Schmidt, Arnie Arneson are with us for Politics Day, talking about gays in the military. Lucy from Des Moines is on the line. Lucy, welcome to the program.
Well, I think as far as that issue, I just wish we'd go on with it. That's what we voted for Obama to do, what he wanted to do, and on the other issues, too, that he wanted to do. I'm kind of following up with the On Point program that came before, where they're saying there's such a gridlock in Congress, nothing is getting done. The Republicans don't want to vote for anything even that they want, because they want the Obama to fail, obviously. And let's just say, okay, the Democrats won the election. Let's have them do what they want to do and say, get over it.
Lucy, do you think it's more the fault of the Republicans for trying to stand in the way, or for the Democrats that they are not able to coalesce their majority into action?
I think it's the Republicans. I think the party of no, I'm so sick of, I could just scream. I think it's terrible.
Lucy, do you think that the Democrats would act differently if there was a 60-40 split in favor of Republicans? Do you think the Democrats would become the party of no, or do you think they would coalesce and say, okay, the Republicans won the national election, let them go forward with their agenda?
Well, in the far past, they did learn how to work together and get something done. And we've got to get to that point again. You know, if they're all going to say nothing, the other party, it had to be working together. And this time it's not doing that. And I think the 51 majority, it's kind of maddening that it takes 60 to do anything.
Lucy, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. Steph and Arnie, what are your takes on Lucy's thoughts?
Well, Lucy, I absolutely applaud what you say. And in fact, we'll just touch on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, because John McCain is the perfect poster child for this issue. John McCain, when he was running for president, am I correct here, Stephan, or am I remembering a different election? I thought he didn't like that policy, you know? I mean, I think in some ways almost so many of the policies right now that Barack Obama has embraced, and this really almost gets to his conversation with the Republicans in Congress, were things that Republicans had waxed poetic about, had supported in the past, and talked about that would bring some kind of fiscal integrity or moral integrity or, you know, avoid the dishonesty. And suddenly, because Barack Obama has mentioning it or making it part of his agenda, it must by definition be wrong. And I think that's where there is such hypocrisy now that it begins to smell, because everyone has short-term memory loss. Well, the problem is that it's okay if it's my 90-year-old aunt. It's not okay if it's Republican members of Congress.
Well, the other thing is, Arnie, and Jonathan, that the Democrats have done a terrible, terrible job reminding people where the Republicans stood on issues before. There are video clips, you know, of McCain saying we got to do away with this. There are little, you know, 5-second clips of Republicans saying all kinds of things that they're not saying now. Where is now the spending of money to try and build support for the Democratic agenda? The Republicans always do that. You know, where is the flip-flop commercial? You don't only run those when an election is underway. You also run those when your opposition is basically impeding progress on your agenda. And the Republicans did it. Roger Ailes, you know, and the whole White House political machine of Karl Rove, with their allies in the public interest groups, you know, the Republican interest groups, did a fantastic job all the time during the legislative sessions. And the Democrats are doing nothing. I gave a talk this morning to a Democratic women's breakfast, and they were despondent. They were desperate, because they said, where is the Democratic Party? Who is the chair of the DNC? Where are they in all of this trying to explain things? And, you know, when I go to the Republican women's breakfast, if I'm invited, I'm probably going to find that they're the most upbeat club in town.
What do you both of you think of Lucy's assertion that it's more the fault of the Republicans that they're the party of no than it is the fault of the Democrats for not being able to coalesce their majority into action?
Well, see, I don't blame the Republicans. I think the Republicans, sadly, are doing what I almost expected them to do. The Republican behavior is so damn predictable, Jonathan. The Democratic behavior is exhausting. I'm going to tell you right now, it is exhausting. Not only, as Stefan says, they are not fighting, but they're not recognizing that majorities have meaning. You know, they won. They didn't kind of coast. They won. Okay, they may be wrong, and they'll learn in the next election whether they're wrong, but they won, and that requires them to do something and accomplish something. And I'll give you an example. There was a poll that just came out that said the Democrats are damned if they do and damned if they don't on health care. Okay? That people are so disgusted and so confused, and I think in some ways that's liberating. You know why that's liberating, that poll? That means they should do the right thing instead of the weasel thing, instead of the thing that sort of makes all these accommodations to everything they know will ultimately make healthcare less effective, more costly, and ultimately fail. So rather than, you know, give them a piecemeal piece of Swiss cheese, they should just go to the mat, do what they ultimately believe in, and say, okay, if we are wrong, we will die on our sword. But if we were right, guess what? This will last us for the next decade to come. But instead, we have a bunch of wusses. And that's what's unfortunate. The Republicans are doing what I expected. The Democrats are doing, oh, my God, I don't know what.
Well, I agree with Arnie. I think that if you blame it on the Republicans,
exactly,
you let the Democrats off the hook for a very bad strategy, just as you can't blame the Tea Party and the Republicans for the victory of Scott Brown in Massachusetts, you also have to blame the Democrats for running a terrible campaign, being lackadaisical, taking things for granted. And I cannot understand either. You remember Newt Gingrich when the contract with America was in his pocket and he won? He went and rammed through every single piece of policy, even though the Democrats has a sizable number in both houses. He didn't have a 60 majority, and he rammed through everything anyway because that's what the voters had elected him and the conservative Republicans to do in 1994. And that's the mission of the party that wins, is they ought to implement their agenda. If they can get the opposition party on board with some things, then that's just icing on the cake, and that's wonderful. But if you can't, you still have to fulfill your commitments. And I think what Obama needs to have is three things on his contract for America, you know, three bulleted points, and put them in the pocket of every single Democrat and say, these are the three things we promised to do, and then just concentrate on those and ignore everything else, including immigration and education and all of that stuff, until next year. He has so muddled the message that the public is really confused, and they need to now bite the bullet.
And can I give an example, Jonathan? I'll never forget this. When I was running many years
ago. No, Arnie, you can't give an example.
Oh, sure.
Because
sure.
He's got a caller on the line.
Well, just real quick, let me just say a thing. I remember having a meeting with the National Rifle Association, and they, of course, looked at me like I was, you know, the evil child because I was, you know, for gun control and all this stuff. And I looked at them and I said, sweethearts, you've got nothing to worry about. And they looked at me and I said, because you're not on my top three agenda, my top five agenda, my top 10 agenda. I said, I'm looking at a hemorrhaging economy. I'm looking at revenues in the toilet. I'm looking at property taxes at a site. Trust me, guns aren't going to be part of my lexicon. Yeah. I said, if you have a problem with guns, then talk to members of the legislature. But sweetheart, your problem isn't with me. I'm not going to go to the mat for it. I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to use my bully pulpit for it. It is right now not what I am thinking about. And they were blown away. They didn't know what to do. They couldn't get angry because I was so damn honest about what I was triaging. And trust me, they weren't part of the triage.
Before we get to the bottom of the hour, I want to get to just a couple more calls on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Let's start with Tom in Van Horn. Tom, welcome to the program.
Thank you for taking my call. My comment or suggestion would be, in the military, if you look back in history, a quick gloss over the Buffalo Soldiers, the all-black cavalry, in the conquering of the West. You had the Second World War, the Tuskegee Airmen. You had black soldiers in their own division or regiment. You had Japanese Americans that could only fight in Europe, and they were all decorated, some of them vastly past regular troops. Why don't they make a division or a battalion up of not just gays, but anybody that doesn't care? If you're professional, you're a soldier, or you're a Marine, you're a sailor, you don't care, it's not a question, and see how they perform as a non-entity.
Well, Tom, to take that to its conclusion, should we then have specialized military units that don't care what your religious background is, so that if you do not want to serve next to somebody of a different religious background, you don't have to? Should we have military units that are all male? Because if you don't want to serve with women, you shouldn't have to? I mean, to what level do you take this level of segregation then?
Well, I don't know. Let's start at the one with the gays first, or the people that may be or may not be, and take it from there.
I think it's called Plessy versus Ferguson, separate but equal. I think that got overturned.
That's an interesting perspective. Plessy, thank you very much for your call, Tom. I appreciate it. We're going to head to our bottom of the hour break here. We'll have more of your phone calls and emails after the break, and we will start off with talking about President Obama going into the lion's den and speaking to Republicans. That's coming up after the break on Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Your tax dollars pay for cattle grazing on public lands, and then you pay again. This is the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham. The U.S. Forest Service is announcing it will not increase fees for ranchers who let their animals graze on public lands. Rebecca Williams has been looking at this. You say this is making some environmentalists hopping mad.
It is. So here's how it works. Ranchers have to pay to let their cows, sheep, and goats eat plants on public land. And this year, that monthly fee is staying put at $1.35 for each what's called an animal unit. That's a cow and her calf, or five sheep, let's say. Taylor McKinnon is with the Center for Biological Diversity, and when I talked to him, he said that livestock grazing is one of the reasons species like the desert tortoise and the Mexican gray wolf are in so much trouble. And he says taxpayers are subsidizing livestock grazing, and then they're paying again to fix the damage it creates.
We have the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, whose recovery programs are spending tremendous amounts of money to recover species who have been imperiled by livestock grazing.
McKinnon says raising grazing fees would increase costs for ranchers. No one at the National Cattlemen's Beef Association was available for comment.
And then we pay the prices we do at the grocery store. Okay, thanks, Reb.
You're welcome.
This is the Environment Report. James Hansen is the author of The Storms of My Grandchildren, The Truth About the Coming Climate Catastrophe and Our Last Chance to Save Humanity. This is the second half of our interview with Hansen. He's a climate scientist for NASA and was the first scientist to testify before Congress about climate change. He stresses he's not speaking for the government, but only for himself. Dr. Hansen, in the book, you say we should scrap the cap-and-trade scheme to reduce greenhouse gases and instead go with a fee on fossil fuels and then give that money to the people directly to help them adapt to higher energy costs. How would that work?
The fee would be charged at the mine or the wellhead or the port of entry for imported fossil fuels, collected from the fossil fuel companies, and then the money should be distributed to the public on a uniform basis. You would introduce this gradually so that people have a chance to change their habits, the technology that they use, the vehicles that they drive, for example. So you introduce it gradually, but by the time it's reached $1 a gallon on gasoline, at the rate of fossil fuel use last year, that would be generating $3,000 per legal resident of the country, with half a share to each child, up to two children per family. So a family with two or more children would be getting $9,000 a year in this dividend, which should be sent to them monthly, just automatically, electronically.
We're talking about getting that through Washington, D.C., where special interests drive the agenda often. I don't want to accuse you of being naive, but I think many in Washington would.
Yes, they do. However, there's a growing realization. Environmental groups like Friends of the Earth, which now recognize that this is exactly what's needed, and they're beginning to promote that. I think that's why it's a good thing that we're probably taking a year off dropping this cap in trade and give us a chance to discuss this, because it's what is in the interest of the public as opposed to the lobbyists.
James Hansen is the author of The Storms of My Grandchildren. Dr. Hansen, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
That's the Environment Report. I'm Lester Graham.
Support comes from the Park Foundation and the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. You can find more information and post your comments at environmentreport.org. The Environment Report comes from the University of Michigan.
This is Talk of Iowa on Iowa Public Radio. I'm Jonathan Aull. Stefan Schmidt and Arnie Arneson are political analysts for this hour on Politics Day. Also taking your emails and phone calls, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or 866-780-9100. We've received an email from Erin, who says that she watched the entire address that Obama gave to the RNC retreat and thought he knocked their socks off. This is a reference to President Obama going, I believe it was in Baltimore, to a retreat at the RNC and taking some pretty frank questions from members of the RNC. Steph and Arnie, did he accomplish anything by doing that? Was that a good move for him?
He terrified them. They'll never take him off script again. But don't you see what happened there? Stefan, I know you know this is the case, is that he wasn't scripted. He didn't have a teleprompter. He got to eyeball his opposition. He's very smart. He's very charming. And he's a lawyer. He loves this stuff. He's good at this stuff. He has an incredible repertoire of information about every member of Congress. So he knows when, you know, they said one thing 2 years ago and they say something today. And as a result, what he was able to do was to really wrap them up in their own language and respond to them in a way that the American people saw both his wit and ability, as well as the fact that what the Republicans were saying seemed not to follow consistently with what they've said in the past. Just what we were just talking about before. What should have been happening for the last year only happened when he stood in front of members of Congress who happened to have an R next to their name.
How and you know, if we had a parliamentary system like Britain,
it
would be fantastic.
Exactly.
He would be in there for, you know, Prime Minister's question hour, and the opposition would throw things at him, and then his party would go, and he would nail him to the wall, and he would be fantastic like that. The big problem is he's over there isolated in the White House. He has no opportunity to come to Congress and either whip his own party into shape or to take on the opposition, which apparently the Democrats just simply can't do. I mean, I guess I wouldn't be surprised because Harry Reid is not a fantastic leader, if I can put it mildly. And so when he met with them like that, it was, you know, David going into with the Goliaths or into the lion's den or whatever it is and coming out smiling. And it was very good. But as Arnie, I think, said, Jonathan, I don't think they're ever going to invite him back to anything.
And can I make a recommendation? Because one of the things that he even said is, you know, you've got it so spun that everyone assumes that my actions are communist or socialist. And so he was very cute about it. Well, here's my challenge to Barack Obama, and I might as well say it in Iowa. And that is, I want Barack Obama to sit down in a televised hour and a half with a group of progressive members of Congress and progressives and do the same thing. You see, I think it's much easier for him to handle Republicans whose answer is no, no government, no taxes, no this, no that, than it is to come in front of a group of people who ultimately come from where Barack kind of thinks he belongs, which has a little bit more progressive values, but has so failed on so many of those issues in the last year because he's willing to sell out piecemeal by piecemeal everything he ran on when he ran in 2008.
Yes,
so I think that would be a real challenge, and I would love to watch that televised, and I'll sell the popcorn.
You mentioned the Prime Minister's questions in Britain. My favorite part of that is you can say whatever you want about anybody as long as you refer to them as the Right Honorable Gentleman. We've got a Right Honorable Gentleman on the line, Mitch from Des Moines. Mitch, what do you think President Obama has toughened up in recent weeks?
Well, I agree with the discussion. I think he took him to school last Friday. It reminded me, it's the new Obama, but the new Obama is the old Obama back in the campaign from 2007 and early 2008, at least here in Iowa. And it just, I felt, kind of like he was back in the campaign trail. But what he was trying, the message that I got that we was trying to tell the, at least the Republican leadership, you could be part of the solution. But if you continue to be part of the problem, this is it. We have to move on. Our citizens want us to solve problems now. If you continue to be roadblocks to the solutions, okay, this is it.
But Mitch, I think also what part of the problem is here is Barack Obama ran talking about the fact that he was going to do politics differently, that he was going to really sort of be a conciliator, he was going to work with the Republicans, he really wanted to dialogue, he wanted to find consensus. And I think what's happened is after a year, and it's more than just a roadblock, I mean, it's a Berlin Wall that they've put up. It's gotten so difficult. The moat has gotten bigger and bigger and more shark infested. And I think he said, okay, I gave the year. I played Mr. Nice. I turned the other cheek, and instead I come out with no teeth. So you know what? It's over, sweetheart. And this was really where he could throw the gauntlet down, and where he had to throw it down is in front of the public, in front of the Republican members of Congress, and say, this is who I am. Now you will see what I want to accomplish. How sad that he had to wait a year, though, because a year has so undermined so much of what he's trying to do.
Thanks a lot, Mitch, for your call. We do have another perspective on it. We want to go to Jay in West Point. Jay, you have a different take on the president's appearance before the Republicans.
Well, I would never quibble. I thought it was a tour de force with the president. And, he just – the only one that could have done that is that I could – Bill Clinton in my lifetime, maybe JFK. And it wasn't on cameras when they did it, But what I want to say about the Republican leadership in the Congress – NPR on Talk of the Nation ran 15 minutes of clips, and they were kind of like mild ones. They needed to focus on what the leadership came up with. They had days to give their best gotcha questions to Obama, even if the cameras were on or off. And what did they come up with? Pence, who's like the big leader, he said, well, we had a stimulus package that would have cost half of what yours did, and we would have twice the jobs. And then this big medical care, like this, you know, Georgia congressman or whatever, he's supposed to be a doctor probably, he says, well, it would have lowered premiums and coverage for all and better quality, and it wouldn't have cost one extra penny. And it's like, could you be more outlandish and more – and by the way, they are so driven, drugged down by their Tea Party dependency that they have no constructive anything at all. It's shocking. They used to have something like Newt Gingrich, who was intellectual, had something constructive maybe. They got nothing.
Well, now
Jay,
but they're the minority party at the moment. Do they have to do anything constructive, or is it satisfactory for them to just stand in the way of
the
other party?
Well, they claim they care about America. What's if you're not based on facts and you don't have anything that's going to work, then why spit it out there?
Do you think the Democrats were productive when President Bush was?
I think a lot of them went along with a lot of stuff. Yes, they did.
So,
well, I think
Steph Arney, what are your takes
Bush,
on that?
But first of all, President Bush had something Barack Obama didn't have, and I pray to God, and I'm lighting candles right now, that he doesn't have, and that's 9/11. And as a result, is that collective fear, that response to what happened, really made people much more afraid of challenging what did Bush know, when did he know it, how much information, we have to have a collective front. I mean, Bush had a huge welcome mat that unfortunately was, you know, had 9/11 on the welcome mat, and that really changed his relationship with Congress probably for years to come.
Yep,
and that's both a bad thing. And look at members of the White House press corps. What did they call them? They were so angry at the press corps because they didn't even ask the tough questions, let alone Democratic members of Congress. They started referring to the White House press corps as nothing more than stenographers to power.
That's
so
right.
It was a very different setting, and you can't really compare how Democrats behaved with Bush with what's going on right now with Obama.
And it was the Pearl Harbor syndrome is what I call it, in which you cannot take on a president when the country is at war and under physical attack. And it benefited Bush greatly. I think Bush himself regretted it a lot. He didn't want to do foreign policy all that much. You know, some people think that Dick Cheney and some of his cabinet actually were hungry to go after Saddam Hussein. But, you know, so Barack Obama derailed himself, really, because he had a mandate. He had a terrific turnout in terms of electoral college and popular vote. He got a robust Congress, two elections in a row. The Democrats picked up seats. And then he somehow, you know, we're talking about the new Obama, the old Obama. He's actually gone back to the old Obama. The old Obama was a legislator in Illinois who could never make up his mind, who was a conciliator, who never wanted to get into fights, who could very often voted, you know, present instead of yes or no because he didn't want to offend anyone or he wasn't really sure what the right thing was. And that's the Obama that was president in the first year in which he let Congress run amok and develop a health care package of their own. And you know what? Can I say this on the air, Jonathan? Well, I'm going to say it anyway. If we get into trouble, it's not with the FCC. The reason Barack Obama went after health care reform, there's one reason, and it's a tragedy. It's Ted Kennedy. Barack Obama owed Ted Kennedy his Iowa caucus victories because Ted Kennedy did a lot for him here. He owed him the nomination probably. And he saw Ted Kennedy as his mentor, and he had to do health care reform because Kennedy was going on his deathbed, and he wanted that legacy.
Sweetheart, I love you. I love you, but you know what? I hate to say it. Teddy wasn't the only one who has been passionate about health care. Frankly, if he talked to business people who ran large corporations and looked at their pensions and look at their liabilities and look at the Pac-Man of their bottom line, which was the increasing cost of providing health care benefits for their workers, trust me, those boys were in his head. People like me who've been grieving since Hillary Clinton lost Hillary Care in the early 90s were in their head. There are too many reasons to do it, both economically and morally And, I mean, Medicare and Medicaid is killing us as a nation. Unless we figure out a way to bring everyone into the system, the government will implode with the aspect of health care they are covering, because they are covering the oldest and sickest of us, and that is a definition for government failure.
Okay.
It wasn't just Teddy.
Exit question before we go on to a new topic, and that is a president that inherited a lot of problems and some really bad situations, who had a majority of his party in both houses of Congress, yet through weak leadership, arguably, and not and some other issues, was viewed generally as a failure as president. Is Barack Obama going to repeat Jimmy Carter's time in office? Because the parallels seem to be starting to line up. Steph, Arnie, your take on that?
I'll go first. He is at risk of that happening. And remember that Jimmy Carter had the same kind of problems, which was that he couldn't really decide what to do. And he had, you know, Iran, and he had international foreign policy crises, and he had a terrible economy with interest rates out of control, unemployment soaring, so yes, there is a risk that Obama can't get this all back together and focus on something and herd the cats in the right direction, because he didn't have to do health care reform in the first year. I agree with Arnie about everything else, but he didn't have to do it the first year. His hands were so full with bank bailouts, mortgage foreclosures, with a war that we're losing in Afghanistan. He did not have to pile health care on top of it, scare the heck out of everybody, and therefore lose the trust of those Americans who have health care reform now, who have health insurance now, who are scared to death about what the reform is going to do because they don't understand it.
Stephanie,
he should have waited, and any good advisor would have told him, don't do it this year.
Stephan, the biggest mistake he made was that it took too long to fix it. If he had gotten health care done by June, by August, by September, it would be a moot point. The problem is, it was like the Lilliputians, and they brought him down, nick by nick, time by time, and it was the right thing to do in the first 6 months. It began to smell like dead fish by the time it showed up in February.
Healthcare reform,
it's my
Arnie, healthcare reform is like trying to fix the problem of climate change. It is too huge. No one can swallow it. You'll choke on it. Everybody is choking on it as you try to ram it down their throats. And then they spit it up and walk away from you. And that's why the climate change conference in Copenhagen failed, is because it's so gigantic that everybody in some respect or another felt threatened by it. He should have done health care reform in a different way, not by saying, I want health care reform. I want to cover everybody. I want costs controlled and so on, and do everything at once. It is gigantic. And any politician that you will ask will tell you it's hard to do things that are as huge as that. You could have done it piece by piece over the next few years. You might have even gotten a few Republicans on board each of those pieces.
Let's move on to another topic in the last
hour, Jonathan. I'm just
I know, I was going to say.
The second hour.
Let's re-rack that for next week. You guys know I like talking about history a little bit. When the Mercury 7 astronauts were introduced to the United States, it was a moment of national pride. It was a time where millions of Americans were inspired, where the country went into a different direction. Fast forward and look at the astronauts that lost their lives in the space shuttle explosions. It was a time where the country coalesced. Recently, a new seven people were introduced as being the pioneers of space exploration in the future, and they were the CEOs of private companies that the government may rely on for space exploration if President Obama's proposal to cut NASA's budget and go in that direction moves forward. Stephan, Arnie, is this a good move or a bad move for the administration?
We have now outsourced everything. We've outsourced our military. We've outsourced NASA. We've outsourced our government. Look what we have done. Everything is now a contract, and nothing is a collective responsibility or a collective dream, Jonathan. I want everyone – there's a book by Michael Hart called The 100, and it's the 100 most influential people in human history. He put JFK in that group of the 100 most influential people in human history. Why? Because JFK said, someday I want to land a man on the moon. And not only did he say it, but he funded it.
Let me challenge you on that for just a second, Arnie. If there is, I mean, because we are a capitalist nation and nobody apologizes for that, if there is a benefit to you and I here on the ground, outside of the inspiration factor, if there's a real benefit to us to having men and women in space and space exploration, doesn't it make some sense to have the private sector helping guide that agenda?
The private sector has benefited from every single thing we've done with NASA.
I didn't say benefit. I said guide the agenda.
We've done with the defense. It's not only they, but they've always been part of the agenda. They've been actually part of the trickle down of that agenda. They have benefited from the technology and from the collective wisdom and from the new things that we've been able to dream up, and then they've commercialized it, improved on it, and moved forward. They've always been a piece of it, Jonathan. They really have.
And let me jump in here, because you have to remember that JFK would never have gotten any of the money appropriated and gotten a space program going if it hadn't been for two things. Sputnik,
Russia,
was a tremendous embarrassment to the United States when the Soviet Union put up the first satellite in orbit, and number two, the Cold War. The whole U.S. space program was justified not as great science and conquering new frontiers and Star Trek and all that. That it became that, but it was justified and paid for, and the American people were willing to write checks because it was our battle against the evil communists. So now, if Obama wants a space program, he's got to launch it as a war against Islamic jihadists, and maybe we can get a little money. At this point, the space program probably needs private sector in it. There are a lot of private sector groups that are launching rockets, that are interested in space exploration, developing new products. I don't see anything terrible. We don't need another man on the moon. Frankly, a lot of scientists are saying it's a waste of time. A lot of scientists are saying we shouldn't send any more manned missions because it is not the most efficient way to get results in terms of scientific research, basic research, and applied research. You got a bunch of people floating around, and very often those experiments and things could be done other ways. The space program does probably need to be revisited. It's very expensive. But frankly, our biggest costs are the war in Afghanistan, Iraq, and the gigantic new military budget that the Defense Department has, which Arnie sent something around. It's the biggest budget, military budget since World War II. It's bigger than Korea. It's bigger than Vietnam. It's bigger than the average of the cold during the entire Cold War. That I don't know if that's justified. I think we need to have a conversation about that.
Jonathan, you're a student of history, so let's be a student of history. How did Ronald Reagan break the back of the Soviet Union? By making them spend themselves into submission. Because they kept spending and spending to fight us, and spending and spending to fight us. And eventually they said, I give up. We cannot. You broke our backs. I almost see history repeating ourselves, only it is us that are being driven to our knees, because we are going to be spending ourselves into not second place, but 22nd place.
Specifically, are you talking about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Go look at the most recent defense budget, and then take a reading by David Sanger. David Sanger just wrote a piece today in the New York Times. Everybody, you must read it. You must read it. It is mind-blowing, because it basically says we are now spending ourselves into being not a world power, but being a second-rate power.
Well, let me just explore that on one more front, Arnie. If you look at the percentage of the defense budget, the compared to the total government spending, it still gets dwarfed by a lot of other programs that no one would even dream of touching.
No one is disagreeing with you. No one is disagreeing with you. But between the deficits and between the size of the defense budget and the fact that we are now spending, I mean, the defense budget is so huge, and it's still a significant part of our budget. You have to understand, the article that he writes, he basically says that what we have now is, as debt grows rapidly, the country's influence over the world is eroded. So it's kind of ironic. We're building up our defense budget, so somehow we can have greater influence. But as a consequence of rising deficits and this defense budget, we are actually eroding our influence. It sounds like a lose-lose to me. We are losing domestically, and we are losing on the world front.
And earlier this week, China became, I think, is coming up on Japan as overtaking Japan as the second biggest economy in the world, if I recall correctly. Is that the ranking we should be more worried about as the years come on here?
Stefan.
Yeah, well, you know, ranking schmanking. What we should do is concentrate on modernizing our economy. I don't really care how we compare to China or other places in terms of various things. They have 1.5 billion people almost. They can outrank us in almost everything, you know, because they have so many people. But the point is, we need to go back and do what Ford appears to be doing, build better things, bring back industry, create more jobs in the United States that people can do here, because we're frittering away our money, putting it into the internet and shipping it in digital form to the Chinese who are accumulating almost all of the American wealth as we import their stuff, and they don't buy very much from us.
Unfortunately, that's
the failure of Toyota is an opportunity for Ford.
That's all the time we have today for Talk of Iowa. Steph and Arnie, we'll talk to you again next week. Our program is produced by Dennis Reese. Assistance this week from John Pemble and Christina Sarnelli. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa is available at iowapublicradio.org, where you can always send your comments and questions about the show, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme was composed and performed by Dan Knight. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Jonathan Aull. Thanks for joining us.